Welcome to Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. Well, we've got a range of topics on today's show. We'll hear the FBI director confirming that there's an investigation into possible Russian meddling in the U.S. election. James Comey also confirmed today that neither the FBI nor the Justice Department has any proof of wiretapping claims by Trump. We'll also have guests on to talk about science under attack by the Trump administration. Plus, we'll hear about wiki equality and art and feminism Wikipedia edit-a-thon, and we'll take your calls. Here's the number to call if you'd like to get in the queue right now, 813-239-9663. You can email your question or comment to dj@wmnf.org. You can text us at 813-433-0885. We'll hear from FBI Director Comey in just a few minutes, but right now I want to talk about our first topic. Our first guests today are part of a panel discussion this afternoon at USF. It's called Science Under Attack. Dr. Parmveer Bahia is a research associate at USF Health, and she's director of Scientists, Inc. That's a science outreach nonprofit. And Aaron Sauer is a PhD candidate in the Department of Integrative Biology at USF. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Parmveer and Aaron.
Thank you for having us, Sean.
Thank you for having us.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start first with this. Is science under attack by the Trump administration?
I think personally for me, science has been under attack for a long time, but that might be partly because people don't understand what scientists actually do. But it does feel like efforts have been concentrated more recently, and certainly for somebody working under an NIH grant, the proposed budget cuts recently they would be very impactful to us.
An NIH grant, that's National Institutes of Health.
Exactly.
So tell us what you do and what kinds of things you would get grants for.
Well, I work in the lab for a scientist called Thomas Taylor Clark, and our group is researching the role of the nervous system within diseases that would normally be considered to be immunological. That's namely things like asthma and COPD. And a large part of that NIH grant that comes to our lab would be covering the funding for both the students, the scientists themselves, plus any consumables and things like that we use. And it would make it certainly far more difficult for us to do our work.
And let me ask you, Aaron, what kind of research do you do and how might science funding affect that?
Well, I am in Jason Rohrer's lab in the Department of Integrative Biology at USF, and we do lots of disease ecology and toxicology work. So personally, I look at how thermal biology of the host can impact disease susceptibility, and I've received grants from Army Corps engineers to do behavioral thermoregulation stuff with, or how animals might alter their behavioral thermoregulation in response to disease exposure. And that Army Corps of Engineer grants are actually one group that's been proposed some budget cuts under this Trump budget. Our lab also receives grants from the EPA and the USDA and NSF. EPA funds a lot of pesticide research, and we do some work with how pesticides can influence disease ecology, particularly with schistosomiasis, which is a worm that infects humans in usually in the third world. And pesticides can have some interesting interactions with the snail intermediate host and boost pathogen exposure in the human populations.
So both of you, Aaron and Parmveer, you're both part of this panel discussion this afternoon at USF. It's called Science Under Attack, and it's at 4:00 in the building called MSC, room number 3705, the Manatee Room, and it's in association with the Graduate Research Symposium. Why are you having this symposium, this panel discussion rather, why are you having it, and who will be there? Who will be the people presenting besides you?
So I'm actually leading the discussion. I'll be moderating this afternoon. And largely this is the work of Suzanne Young, who really has been championing the role of USF and how our science is portrayed and protected. As for the panel themselves, I think Erin, as one of the panel members, would probably know better.
On the panel, I'll be representing the graduate students. We have Jody Harwood, I believe, as a faculty representative. Girard, the university's general counsel.
Yeah, and there's also, I have the list here, there's also an associate dean for research, Randy Larson, and Paul Sandberg, who's vice president for research of innovation and economic development. So you have scientists and students on this panel, but you also have a representative from the USF administration, the top level of the school, the university general counsel. I assume this would be someone who might answer directly to President Genschaft.
Yep.
Why is it important for you to have someone from the USF administration on this panel?
I think for me personally, part of the problem is that we don't understand what the university can and can't do with regards to standing up for us and what happens under certain circumstances if a particular scientist is highlighted as somebody whose work is going to be adversely affected in a given way. So for me, it would be interesting just to know how the university can respond, not whether they will.
And speaking of responding and the university responding, and earlier you mentioned Suzanne Young a few months ago, I guess it was, I interviewed her. Our listeners might be familiar with this story where the students and the faculty and the researchers at USF, once Donald Trump was elected, they said to USF, you wrote a letter saying, we are concerned what might happen at USF under the Trump administration to scientists and to researchers and to federal funding and so forth. And initially, there was no response at all from the university administration, is what we reported. But since then, the USF administration has told me they have responded. What's been the response so far to that letter?
So the response was of course we support science, but let's wait and see what's actually going to happen with this administration. We specifically wanted them to address concerns about climate change funding and climate change research being supported at the university. And they sort of didn't mention that at all. And they just sort of took this wait and see approach. And we've waited and we've seen what the administration's targets are, and it's slashing science at every possible space where they can, particularly climate science.
So what's your response to the USF's response? How do you feel about that response?
I think it didn't go as far as it needed to go. I don't see why they needed to take a wait and see approach when it was apparent from the cabinet positions that Trump appointed and the things that Trump has said in the past that this wasn't going to be a science-friendly administration. So for them to sort of say, well, we don't know, that might actually not be that bad, they could have just made a statement like, of course we support climate change and we agree that climate change is caused by human activity or whatever. Because there's tons of climate change research going on at USF, and it seems kind of silly that they would fund all this research and support all this research and then not stand behind the research that they're producing.
For example, the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt recently said that carbon dioxide is not the human created carbon dioxide is not the main driver of climate change. That's what the EPA Administrator said, and a lot of the grants that go to the university from the federal government are from the EPA. So it seems like they're, and a lot of them are looking at carbon dioxide and how it affects climate, and then on down the line, how that climate change affects the biology and the chemistry and so forth. So it seems like wait and see what we've seen is what you're telling us, and that there are statements that there will be changes in how science is funded and how science is viewed from the from the Trump administration. And yet your university is kind of still taking a cautious approach, I guess.
Yeah, so part of the hope of this panel is to now address, since we've waited and seen, we can ask the university again, what are you going to do to support the science that you're already doing and support the research that you're already producing in regards to climate change or pesticide influences, or I think there's a number of NIH cuts happening too. So there's tons and tons of places where funding's being cut. And I think federal grants and contracts are the second largest revenue source for the university. And federal federally sponsored research makes up, I think, about 20% of the university's revenue. So this is a huge chunk of the incoming money to the university that they depend on to fund their professors, fund their graduate students, run their research, keep the lights on, as they like to say. And they should be supporting that research if they expect to continue to bring in that revenue and continue to exist as a educational institution or Research One University.
Our guests are Aaron Sauer, a PhD candidate in the Department of Integrative Biology at USF. We also have Parmveer Bahia, a research associate at USF Health. And, you know, you were talking about getting grant money and how much grant money is a part of the university, how much it relies on it, essentially. And people might think, okay, well, you get grant money from a federal agency like the EPA, and all that money goes into test tubes and beakers and things like that. But there's also something called overhead. Explain overhead and how that might tie into this idea of the university wanting to make sure that science funding from federal agencies continues.
So essentially what the overhead is a kind of, it's us paying rent as scientists to the university for the ability to have the space and the resources in order to be able to carry out our research. And as you say, that forms a significant proportion of the money that comes in from the grant. So if we don't have the grant money, then they don't have the overhead. And that's a huge decrease in the amount of money they'll receive.
So let's say you design an experiment to look at something about asthma, and you think that to do this experiment, it'll cost you $400,000. Well, you have to write, maybe I'm ballparking the numbers here, but you have to write a $500,000 grant from NIH, and they have to give you, you know, the cost of your research plus this percentage overhead that goes straight to the coffers of USF.
Exactly.
To pay for things like secretaries and copy machines and things like that.
Indeed.
If you'd like to join this conversation, here's the number to call, 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Text us at 813-433-0885. We have Glenn on the air in St. Pete. Hi, Glenn. You want to talk about pesticides?
Just a quick kind of a tangent. It would rest upon entirely the state of Florida if it were not for the EPA itself. I mean, I worry about things like the atrazine and the weed and feed and our amphibians and the endocrine disruption. And I just, you know, I've been wanting to like take the time and maybe even write some sort of petition, but now who to get the ball rolling and that kind of thing. You know, atrazine was banned in Europe, and here we are still using it for money because we're denying science just like our administration is. So now it's even harder to kind of make some kind of change like that.
All right, Glenn, thanks for the call. So either of you would either of you like to address the idea that, you know, that if the less funding for science, the less we know about toxins in the environment?
Yes, our funding. I mean, I could only imagine had I completed school, I just enamored with writing. But what kind of ideas and local things, if not global, you know, would I be working on, and would I be relying on that funding to keep it going?
All right, thank
you,
Glenn.
Down to the secretaries, down to the materials, you know.
Great, thanks. Thanks for that call.
Yeah, so without the EPA, the large burden of protecting our water bodies and protecting our environment falls upon the environmental protection agencies at the state level. And while that might be great if you live in California or some other state where your state-level EPA is run well and actually regulates, if you live in Florida or some other state where the state-level EPA is even less funded than it is in Florida, there's huge risks for pesticides being put into the water or being not regulated, so there's even more of them running off into the water. I mean, we have problems with red tide all the time here, and that's not pesticide so much as it's fertilizer, but that's another thing that is regulated by the EPA. The amount of fertilizer you put in the water is regulated by the EPA, or the amount that you put on your farmland is regulated by the EPA. Same with pesticides. And without the federal EPA to answer to, if you're just answering at the state level, the repercussions are lessened, the burden, the actual labor burden of getting people out into the field to regulate is put entirely on the state. It makes it more expensive for the state, and things are going to fall through the cracks, and we're going to see increases in water bodies being polluted or increases in red tide, which can cause or can agitate people with asthma and things like that here. It's a huge problem in Florida. Yeah.
You know, if it's easy to, it might be easy for someone to figure how it would affect science if the EPA funding is cut or NIH funding is cut from the federal level, and then that trickles down to fewer grants or smaller grants or something. That might be easy to figure out. But what has the Trump administration's travel ban, how does that affect science?
I think the primary concern would be for us, the very nature of science is a collaborative endeavor. You have to meet other scientists in order for your results to be discussed and for you to be able to come up with a consensus on a given subject. And so international meetings are hugely important to this. Obviously, this will affect not just people leaving the country, but anyone trying to come into the country, because the vast majority of huge meetings, for example, neuroscience, they're all held in the US. And from a very easy standpoint, it's quite easy to see how that would affect how science proceeds if scientists can't effectively communicate with each other.
Has there been any rumblings under, you know, under the radar here where international scientists, because of the travel ban, are deciding that they might boycott conferences in the United States?
Certainly. I've been following on Twitter a number of them who've said that for the foreseeable future, they will not be attending conferences in the U.S., and that hampers us in the same way.
Yeah, it sounds like it would affect American scientists most of all if that happens negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And then at USF, there's the case of an Iranian student, Mehdi Zeghami, who has, because of the travel ban, was unable to get the visa that he was promised right away. And so for a while, he was stuck in Iran. And he's trying to get a second visa, and we're going to see how that works out. We'll continue to follow that story. But that's another case where you have a scientist who happens to be from another country who's been studying at a university and now is at least temporarily not able to come and study at that university. So that would affect his colleagues, that would affect people who might benefit from his research.
Mm. Yeah, you can certainly see the ripple effect from a single person not being able to come and do the work that they've been hired to do, essentially.
Well, our guests on the show today have been Dr. Parmveer Bahia. She's a research associate at USF Health and director of Scientists, Inc. That's a science outreach nonprofit. And Aaron Sauer, a PhD candidate in the Department of Integrative Biology at USF. Their event today is Science Under Attack. It starts at 4 o'clock. It's at a panel discussion that's at the MSC 3705 room at USF Tampa campus. That's also called the Manatee Room, and it's in association with the Graduate Research Symposium. Thanks so much for joining us on WMNF's Midpoint today, Parmveer and Aaron.
Thanks for having us, Sean.
Thanks. Well, we'll be back in just a minute. We're going to have a music break right now, and in a bit we'll talk about wiki equality, but first we're going to hear about James Comey, the hearings today. Stay tuned. Right after this music break, we'll hear from James Comey. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. It's 12:26 in the afternoon, where we're going to transition to our next topic right now, and that is FBI Director James Comey. He's at a hearing right now in Washington, D.C. He's publicly confirming for the first time that the FBI is investigating Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. The investigation includes any potential coordination between the Trump campaign associates and Russia's government. Here is the opening statement from James Comey, and we'll be back in 4 minutes to talk about it.
I hope we have shown you through our actions and our words how much we at the FBI value your oversight of our work and how much we respect your responsibility to investigate those things that are important to the American people. Thank you for showing that both are being taken very seriously. As you know, our practice is not to confirm the existence of ongoing, especially those investigations that involve classified matters. But in unusual circumstances, where it is in the public interest, it may be appropriate to do so, as Justice Department policies recognize. This is one of those circumstances. I have been authorized by the Department of Justice to confirm that the FBI, as part of our counterintelligence mission, is investigating the Russian government's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And that includes investigating the nature of any links between individuals associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and whether there was any coordination between the campaign and Russia's efforts. As with any counterintelligence investigation, this will also include an assessment of whether any crimes were committed. Because it is an open, ongoing investigation and is classified, I cannot say more about what we are doing and whose conduct we are examining. At the request of congressional leaders, we have taken the extraordinary step, in coordination with the Department of Justice, of briefing this Congress's leaders, including the leaders of this committee, in a classified setting, in detail about the investigation. But I can't go into those details here. I know that is extremely frustrating to some folks, but it is the way it has to be, for reasons that I hope you and the American people can understand. The FBI is very careful in how we handle information about our cases and about the people we are investigating. We are also very careful about the way we handle information that may be of interest to our foreign adversaries. Both of those interests are at issue in a counterintelligence investigation. Please don't draw any conclusions from the fact that I may not be able to comment on certain topics. I know speculating is part of human nature, but it really isn't fair to draw conclusions simply because I say that I can't comment. Now, some folks may want to make comparisons to past instances where the Department of Justice and the FBI have spoken about the details of some investigations. But please keep in mind that those involve the details of completed investigations. Our ability to share details with the Congress and the American people is limited when those investigations are still open, which I hope makes sense. We need to protect people's privacy. We need to make sure we don't give other people clues as to where we're going. We need to make sure that we don't give information to our foreign adversaries about what we know or don't know. We just cannot do our work well or fairly if we start talking about it while we're doing it. So we will try very, very hard to avoid that, as we always do. This work is very complex, and there is no way for me to give you a timetable as to when it will be done. We approach this work in an open-minded, independent way, and our expert investigators will conclude that work as quickly as they can, but they will always do it well, no matter how long that takes. I can promise you we will follow the facts wherever they lead. And I want to underscore something my friend Mike Rogers said. Leaks of classified information are serious, serious federal crimes for a reason. They should be investigated and, where possible, prosecuted in a way that reflects that seriousness so that people understand it simply cannot be tolerated. And I look forward to taking your questions.
Well, that was, of course, FBI Director James Comey, and he was talking today to a panel. He was testifying before Congress, rather. He says he's authorized by the Justice Department to make the disclosure of that the FBI is investigating Russia's efforts to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. Typically, the FBI does not discuss or even confirm the existence of ongoing investigations. Also at that hearing, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee says there was no physical wiretap on Trump Tower, but he says it's possible that other surveillance activities were used against President Donald Trump and his associates. Devin Nunes spoke at the opening of the committee's first public hearing on Russia's interference in the 2016 election. He says the committee has seen no evidence to date that officials from any campaign conspired with Russian agents, but Nunes will continue to investigate that question. Also, one other thing that James Comey said, he confirmed that neither the FBI nor the Justice Department has any proof of wiretapping claims by Donald Trump. So those are just some things that are developing this morning. Of course, we'll fill you in more this afternoon on that. And since there is a person on the line who wants to talk about this, I'll take that call before we move to our next topic. We have Frank in Tampa. You want to talk about the Russian involvement with the 2016 election?
Yeah, Mike in Tampa.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks, Mike.
I'm more sick and tired hearing about the Russians interfering in the elections. So we interfere in their affairs all the time. If they didn't interfere, they had every right to interfere. Considering we interfered in their election, when Yeltsin was one employee election, we spent $100 million for his campaign. And I think it's just a waste of time and a waste of money to investigate that.
All right. I appreciate your thoughts on that, Mike. Thank you so much. And if you'd like to join in on the conversation, whether you want to talk about science in the Trump administration, or if you want to talk about our next topic, which I'll get to in just a second, or about the FBI Director James Comey's testimony today, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org or text us at 813-433-0885. Well, we turn now to our next guest. Tomorrow there will be an event. It's called Wiki Equality, Art and Feminism Wikipedia Editathon. And here to talk about it is Paul Flagg. He's with the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF. It's also called SOLIS. So welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, Paul.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. First off, what is SOLIS?
SOLIS is Student Organizations of Library and Information Science. It is the student chapters of the American Library Association and the Special Libraries Association as well.
So it's students who are interested in library science, which...
Essentially.
If you're like me and you don't know much about library science, what is it?
Oh, goodness. That's not an easy question. SOLIS is mainly for students that are in the Library and Information Science program at USF. And library science pretty much focuses a lot nowadays on access to information and a lot of digital stuff as well. So sort of how libraries are transforming to accommodate the modern age. Essentially.
And the modern age and wiki equality. So there's this term called wiki equality that I'm learning about just now. And your editathon is for wiki equality, art, and feminism. What does art and feminism have to do with wiki equality?
So wiki equality was a term that we sort of coined during one of our meetings earlier on this year. And we wanted to create Wikipedia events that focus on equality, social justice, diversity, and sort of bringing people together. So Wikiquality sort of just, it worked together. Stylistically, it looks fun too. But Art Plus Feminism is actually a separate organization, and that was originally a Wikipedia editathon that focused on the arts and feminism, or women in general. And it sort of focuses more on women editing Wikipedia. So on the Art Plus Feminism website, there's a statistic that says that less than 10% of contributors to Wikipedia are in fact women. So that is sort of showing the I guess the gender gap, essentially, of people who contribute to Wikipedia and how that information can potentially be biased as a result. So if you look at the statistics of Wikipedia contributors, the majority of them are straight white men. And that is something that we, as Solus WikiQuality, we want to focus on closing that gap of diversity and getting more people from different backgrounds to edit Wikipedia and contribute to this online encyclopedia.
So let's say I'm someone who might be able to contribute to, from a knowledge standpoint, but I've never done it from a technical standpoint. Is it something that it's really technically challenging to edit Wikipedia, especially if you're in a group like the group that you're going to be gathering with? Or is it something that people could pick up?
People can definitely pick it up. I would say it does take a little bit of practice. Editing a wiki can be somewhat difficult, and oftentimes you sort of have to toy around with the settings to find what works best for you in terms of editing directly on the wiki. But that is something that we can definitely help with during the event. It would definitely be best if we could get people to familiarize themselves first by creating a username and maybe getting a few edits in beforehand, but we can definitely help with the learning process as well.
And since we keep talking about the event, I should say that the WikiQuality Art Plus Feminism Wikipedia Editathon is tomorrow, March 21st, from 4 in the afternoon until 8 in the evening. It's at Hillsborough Community College Dale Mabry Campus Library, and the building name is DLRC Room 317. And our guest is Paul Flagg. He's with SOLIS, the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF. And we're talking about the Wikipedia Editathon. How do you keep false information from being added to Wikipedia?
That is a good question. Wikipedia has different standards that are set in place for contributors to follow when they're putting information on Wikipedia, and a lot of it has to do with notability and credibility. So usually when you're putting information on Wikipedia, you need to back it up with sources. And when you, for example, create an article that has the majority of information coming from a single source, that will be flagged pretty much and sent for revision by other Wikipedia administrators. And that is sort of just to ensure that the quality of the information is valid. Oftentimes when you have information coming just from one source that doesn't quite contribute to the notability of that source or the credibility as well. So a lot of bots and automatic processes are in place to try to prevent false information from being added.
So would a bot just kind of scan, it's a computer program or some code or whatever that would scan Wikipedia to find out if, for example, that there's only one source for a particular fact? Is that what you're getting at?
Pretty much. There are a bunch of different bots. I'm not really familiar with the technical side of everything Wikipedia. I'm more of an editor, but They do have certain things like that in place, and they always have things with new articles. For example, if you were to create a new article on Wikipedia, it would be revised by somebody else to ensure the quality of it. So it's not like the information that you're adding is all of a sudden just there. And if you do put false information as well, those kinds of things will be tagged to your account. So they'll sort of count as penalties against you in the future on Wikipedia as an editor.
Our guest is Paul Flagg with the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF, or SOLIS. And we're talking about the Wikipedia Editathon that's tomorrow at the Hillsborough Community College, Dale Mabry Campus. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 813-239-9663. If you have a question for Paul, or if you'd like to find out more information, 813-239-9663. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org. Text us at 813-433-0885. It's 12:40 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. Paul, are there examples of people deceptively editing Wikipedia pages for, you know, reasons that might be a little bit nefarious? I don't even want to go there, but are there examples of that?
There definitely are. I couldn't really point out too many specific things, but I have heard of teachers using Wikipedia in their curriculum to prove why students shouldn't use Wikipedia as a primary source for their research. So, for example, in a high school classroom, for example, a teacher might bring up Wikipedia and edit something, put a completely wrong fact in there, and save it and show it to the students to sort of convey that false information can't easily be represented on Wikipedia. Like I said, a lot of times these things will be caught. However, while I was doing work on trying to plan these events, I did come across one example that I thought was really interesting about, I think it was a middle school boy who went on Wikipedia and he went on this page for an animal that's sort of like a kangaroo or something. And in that entry, he wrote something about a nickname for that animal. And apparently that nickname had stayed on Wikipedia for 6 years. And many people had seen it. Many people had sourced it. And it was a completely false fact. So that is just one example of how things can go wrong on Wikipedia and how not everything is caught. That just goes to show that Wikipedia is a wonderful tertiary source. So it maybe shouldn't be used for primary or secondary research, but as far as consulting Wikipedia for just getting a general sense of a topic or just some general information to go off of and maybe start some additional research from, that is exactly what Wikipedia is for.
So in general, if not a lot depends on it, would you agree that Wikipedia might be a good place to learn about things as long as it's not, say, for an exam or for a research topic or for if your life depends on it or something, but just kind of a good way to read up on a topic maybe?
Definitely. And that's one of the reasons why librarians are encouraged to edit Wikipedia, because it is a wonderful learning source. It's not something that you're going to use in professional research by any means, but I read somewhere that if it's, you know, for a bet or something, a bet for $10, then Wikipedia is wonderful to verify that the information is correct. So, sort of like looking in a dictionary or just a thesaurus or another encyclopedia.
Though, those three things that you just mentioned are more seriously edited. Maybe that's like there's a specific editor that's in charge of making sure that everything in that thesaurus or everything in that dictionary is correct, with the exception of, you know, oversight. Whereas there could be wrong or misleading things that just haven't been caught yet on Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest is Paul Flagg. He's with SOLIS, the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF, and we'd like to take your calls, 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org. And we're talking about Wiki Quality, Art Plus Feminism, Wikipedia Edit-a-thon. And so the goal of this is to get more people to more diversity, as you mentioned, more women editing Wikipedia, because as you mentioned earlier, very few do relative to how many men do, straight white males do. Could there be people out there who saying that this event, what you're doing has a political motivation, and therefore by adding information into Wikipedia with a certain political slant or certain motivation, could that be propaganda that you're adding to Wikipedia?
I would say no. There's definitely motivation behind it, but and as political as it may seem, the information that is presented on Wikipedia is not supposed to be biased when written by anybody. So that defeats the purpose of it. The reason that we want to get more diverse perspectives on Wikipedia is to close that gap, like I said before, of just people represented. So on Wikipedia in general, the majority of the content represented is for white men written by white men. Okay, so the goal is to essentially bring more diverse content written by more diverse people. So we want more information written about the Black community or the LGBT community, the disabled or mentally ill community, or women in general as well. So for our last WikiQuality event, we focused on Black History Month, and that centered around important Black figures in today's society. And we created, it was 3 or 4 different pages on relevant Black people today. And we had about 10 people editing, but the goal was to get more diverse content represented on Wikipedia.
And the event that's tomorrow is in conjunction with Women's History Month. So you're specifically trying to get more and more women to edit these Wikipedia pages. And I think that it's obvious with the goal of getting more women participation, getting that diversity. But the other aspect is that it's called art and feminism. So what does art have to do with editing Wikipedia pages?
That's a good question and something I've sort of been trying to figure out. I don't think there's really a concrete answer there. The main goal with Art Plus Feminism as the separate entity is to get more women involved. So I think the art is sort of a side thought. I don't know if that's okay to say, but I do think it is sort of a side thought. In general, it would probably have to do more with getting female artists represented rather than the arts more generally, if that makes sense. I think the feminist side of it is probably the more important part, but focusing on female artists makes it a little more focused, I guess.
Sure. And so our guest is Paul Flagg with SOLIS, the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF. We're going to go to the phones in just a second and take a call from Nate in Odessa. But I'd like to give out the number first, 813-239-9663. If you have a question about these topics, if you have a question about WikiQuality, or if you'd like to email us, it's dj@wmnf.org. Text 813-433-0885. All right, well, let's hear from Nate in Odessa. Nate, what would you like to say?
Oh, well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm like super intrigued on all this because I'm sort of a nerd, and I love anything that's outside the norm. I do have a little bit of concern that maybe, you know, some bias can't get in there or propaganda, but like the gentleman said, in all aspects, you have that worry about the people forward. I actually cover everything you're talking about. I'm an African-American man. I'm 41. I have 3 daughters, and I want to get them involved in stuff like this because I think it's important. My only question is, because I actually been focusing on this, what are you guys doing? Is there a huge community for, like, my wife is white, so obviously our kids are biracial. I don't notice that there's a lot of activity on the biracial community and biracial heroes and things that have happened in the culture of America when it comes to biracial figures, because we have the task of teaching our daughters both sides. So we would also like to see more figures so they say, okay, look to this and look to that. Because, you know, there are worries that my oldest daughter has. She's 21. So I was just wondering, is there another aspect of that going on with what you're doing also?
All right, Nate, good question. Thanks for that question. Paul?
I couldn't hear.
Oh, okay. Paul couldn't hear the question. Nate was asking if there is an effort to reach out to the biracial community to focus on biracial individuals in editing Wikipedia pages. You mentioned last month was Black History Month and you were focusing on the Black community. Mm-hmm. And so Nate's asking about biracial individuals. Has there been an effort?
With the events that we've had thus far, not quite. I would say this is a relatively new development, but last month we did have Black History. This month is Women's History, and we do definitely want to focus on anything that's more diverse, I guess. So I wouldn't disqualify anybody because they're biracial by any means. I think that would probably be more of a reason to try to get them represented. for example, we did have an issue with last event with a Wikipedia page for a woman named Evita Robinson. She is a Black woman who promotes travel amongst underprivileged communities. And we wrote an article for her, and within days it had been marked for deletion, and it had been deleted ultimately due to lack of notability and lack of credibility, which wasn't quite true. If you were to look at the different sources that we found for this woman, Evita Robinson, a lot of them were from Black magazines or online communities, essentially, and most of them were interviews with Evita, but they were definitely more focused. They weren't things from the New York Times or other major publications like that. They were very focused on the Black community, and several Wikipedia editors got together and debated whether the article should stay on Wikipedia. And I think it was about 8 people. Only one of them voted to keep the article because it definitely had room for improvement, but there was a lot of information out there that supported this individual. But the other 7 Wikipedia editors said that it wasn't notable, it didn't have credibility, the sources were no good. And when you look at the sources, they weren't bad sources by any means. They were just from different, smaller, more niche-like mm-hmm. publications. So when it comes to focusing on biracial issues, I think that's something that the Wikipedia community really needs to work on more generally, because in the modern age, we sort of need to redefine what sources are indeed credible, you know, so not everything that is like the New York Times is the only credible source. So maybe like Black News Today, or for example, a Black publication about hair, for example. I mean, that should be considered relevant in today's society.
Especially if it's an interview, like a one-on-one interview, let's say, with a journalist from that paper, let's say, and an individual. I mean, it's essentially, that's a primary source.
I agree. I would
guess. All right, so when that happens, when it's flagged for deletion, does it just go away, or does it stay up there, and then people have, the whole community, I guess, has a say in, well, maybe we need to add things to this rather than just deleting it altogether?
It really depends. I've been on Wikipedia for about a year now, and I'm still not completely familiar with all of the process, because it is very, very intricate. There's a lot of information behind everything you do on editing Wikipedia, as far as the formatting and the styling of everything, the credibility, the notability, the different kinds of sources that you can and can't use. There's a lot that goes on behind it, but I think the Wikipedia community can help by contributing to those particular articles that are marked for deletion. However, once they are marked for deletion, it's hard to keep them online, because if the majority vote is against you, then more than likely that article will be deleted.
Our guest is Paul Flagg. We're going to go to the phones right now. I'm sorry, I want to read an email first. Sorry about that. Carrie says, if someone attends the WikiQuality event, do they have to have an idea of an article they want to write ahead of time, or will there be suggestions available? Can I just edit articles that already exist? Asks Carrie.
You can edit whatever you want, pretty much. It doesn't even have to focus on art or feminism if you don't want it to. But we do have that theme just to make it more focused for you. So if you're not comfortable with that, feel free to edit anything else that you want. But we do have a Wikipedia page where we have suggested articles. One of them is the article for Evita Robinson, which I have listed about a dozen sources for somebody to consult and rewrite the article on. There are also several links under the projects area for Women in Red. I can't really think of the others on
Well, people can see the links, and this is on the Facebook event page for the Wiki.
This is actually on the Wikipedia meetup page.
But I think there's a link to that on the Facebook page because I saw that. And I want to read, I'm going to get to the phones in just a second. We have a couple of people on the line, but I do want to read this text from the 352 area code. Besides just telling people the limited numbers of people editing, how can you motivate women or minorities to be interested in editing Wiki pages? So I guess what would be their motivation for helping out?
That's a good question, and it really depends on your perspective. So we had one individual who came to our last WikiQuality event, and she was motivated to make a difference because of the current political atmosphere. So it wasn't anything directly related to Wikipedia or anything. It was just she wanted to make a difference somehow. And she saw this event focusing on diversity, equality, and social justice. And she said, I need to participate. I want to do something to make a difference, even if it's something as simple as editing Wikipedia pages.
All right, we'll go back to the phone lines. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. It's 12:57 in the afternoon. We have Amy in St. Pete. Hi, Amy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thanks for calling.
Okay, so I just wanted to comment on how some things go. I have a friend who's very good about the health in various subjects on a worldwide level, and she made me aware that when people don't know much about homeopathy, and they'll go on Wikipedia and...
Know much about what? You broke up a little bit. I'm sorry.
Homeopathy.
Okay, continue,
it's
please.
It's a study of medicine that works in the law of similars. So, you know, people will go on and you'll have people, basically there's a banter that goes back and forth that, you know, you can have an actual homeopath write about what homeopathy is on Wikipedia, and then you'll have pharmaceuticals come in there and undermine it, paid employees by pharmaceutical companies, and it's just a hard... battle when you have paid employees that will go on and adjust the subject of homeopathy because it basically undermines pharmaceutical medicine. So I just wanted to make that comment, and I hope that, you know, things can be worked out or thought about a little bit when it comes to holistic medicine. And any kind of holistic medicine shouldn't be undercut by paid employees of pharmaceutical companies.
All right, thanks. Thanks for that call, Amy. Any response?
Well, I completely agree with you, Amy. It's definitely something that... It's a diverse perspective, and it's something that a lot of times the Wikipedia community does not seem to support, which I think is very unfair, but it also sort of falls under the issue of representing diverse content and equally representing different perspectives on Wikipedia. So I think more people should definitely try to fight for including more of that information on Wikipedia. The only issue I would say is to make sure that everything that is written on Wikipedia is backed up by a credible source, because that is a lot of times where the issue originally stems from.
All right, thank you, Amy, for that call. And I want to thank all of our callers. And I want to repeat that where the event is and when: tomorrow, March 21st, from 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 8 o'clock in the evening at the Hillsborough Community College Dale Mabry Campus Library. That's DLRC 317, is the Wiki Equality Art Plus Feminism Wikipedia Edit-a-thons. Thanks so much for joining me on WMNF's Midpoint, Paul.
Thank you so much for having me.
Appreciate you coming on. Paul Flagg is with the Student Organizations of Library and Information Science at USF. It's also called SOLIS. Well, I want to thank everyone who called, emailed, and texted today. If you haven't been able to say your piece yet and you'd like to leave a voicemail, I'll play that next show. It's 813-238-8001, extension 114. I'll play your message next Monday. You can also join the conversation online. That's at wmnf.org/news. Later today, I will put the audio of the show up and you can comment there. WMNF.org/news. You can also comment on Facebook or Twitter at WMNF News. I want to thank Cindy Taylor, Jeff Haynes, and DT today. I'm Sean Canaan. I'm the host of WMNF News Midpoint Monday. Tomorrow at noon, your hero Mark Bureau will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Craig Kopp in executive session. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.